The headlines: the London police chief resigns after a string of criticism and sexism scandals rocked the British capital's force. Inflation in the U.S. climbs to its highest level in 40 years in January, with prices rising by a record 7.5% from a year ago. And thousands of Sudanese return to the streets in their latest mass rally, protesting against last year's military coup. Hello and welcome, everybody. London Police Chief Cressida Dick has resigned. Mayor Sadiq Khan says he has accepted the resignation as he was not satisfied with her job.
Last week, I made clear to the Metropolitan Police Commissioner the scale of the change I believe is urgently required to rebuild the trust and confidence of Londoners in the Met and to root out the racism, sexism, homophobia, bullying, discrimination and misogyny that still exists. I am not satisfied with the Commissioner's response. On being informed of this, Dame Cressida Dick has offered her resignation, which I have accepted.
Khan says it's clear that the only way to start change in London's Metropolitan Police Department requires having a new leadership. Cressida Dick says she was left with no choice after Khan made it clear to her that he had lost confidence in her leadership. The Met has been shaken in recent years by revelations including abduction, rape and murder of a woman by one of its officers. A culture of bullying, racial discrimination and misogyny has also rocked the police force. Journalist and commentator James Tweedy says the Metropolitan Police have been facing a lot of criticism recently, and Mayor Khan had no choice but to replace the police chief.
There is a general feeling about that at the moment. There's been a whole series of scandals just recently. There have been two arrests of police officers in the force for rape since the Sarah Everard case. There's been a couple of incidents where police were caught sending inappropriate messages to each other, joking about murder victims. So, yeah, I don't think she's popular. I don't think anyone will miss her. She'd just been attacked from the left just recently for launching a very strange a police investigation into these alleged parties at Downing Street during the lockdown. This is an offence which is the police do not retrospectively investigate in normal circumstances. And by launching this investigation, she has delayed the official report into it that was being conducted by a civil servant. And people are saying that was her acting to save Boris Johnson. But like I say, it's ironic because she was appointed by a mayor from the Labour Party.
Truck drivers in Italy are threatening to bring the country's economic supply chain to a halt in protest against a huge rise in fuel prices. Road haulage associations are warning that the truckers are going on the warpath. Max Civili has more from Rome.
A number of road haulage associations warned on Wednesday that lorry drivers won't take it anymore and are ready to go on the warpath as petrol, diesel and methane prices continue to surge dramatically in Italy. Higher fuel prices and household energy bills have further swelled living costs for people in Italy, with lorry drivers being among the hardest hit. Fuel prices overall in Italy are now at the highest since 2012. Petrol has gone up in price by almost 20% over the past 12 months, meaning it now costs an average over 9,000 euros more per month for a lorry driver to fill up.
We have sent the government an alert about the rising level of dissatisfaction among lorry drivers as they simply can no longer cover the costs. Drivers are now holding meetings autonomously in several Italian cities, and protests will be staged soon. They are demanding lower gas prices as well as reductions in taxes and tolls.
Lorry driving is the leading form of freight transportation in Italy, as 85% of all goods are shipped by road in the country. That's compared to a European average of about 70%. However, over the past years, Italian lorry drivers have seen their workload significantly decreasing as Eastern European haulers have surged into the Italian market. Italian lorry drivers have staged protests on several occasions over the past years, blockading major ports, borders and the main routes into Italy's cities. Road haulage associations are slated to meet with the government on February 17 in a final attempt to ease the simmering tensions. Max Civili, Rome.
Wall Street has ended sharply lower after an official data showed the U.S. inflation soared to a new four-decade high in January. The data from the U.S. Labor Department shows consumer prices surged 7.5% last month. That's the biggest and higher than expected annual increase in inflation since 1982. The broad increase in prices was led by soaring costs for rent, electricity, and food. The Federal Reserve will probably move to cool down the economy by raising interest rates, as inflation could imperil President Joe Biden's economic agenda. The official data comes as the U.S. economy is still recovering from the pandemic shock. Supply shortages and snags in global supply chains are the principal causes behind the rising inflations and consumer prices. Well, judges and lawyers stage a rally in the Tunisian capital to vent anger at the dissolution of a key judicial watchdog by President Reis Said. Well, more than 200 people gathered outside the main court in Tunis to denounce the decision. After dissolving the Supreme Judicial Council, Said said on Sunday that he would issue a decree effectively scrapping the body and changing it with new counsel. The protesters say the council is the only independent judicial institution in the country and called Said's decision a violation of human rights. The council was one of the last remaining institutions in the country able to work independently of the president. Thousands of Sudanese once again take to the streets to protest against last year's military coup that upended a transition to civilian rule. Crowds waved flags and chanted slogans in the capital Khartoum and its twin city, Omdurman. Security forces fired tear gas to disperse the demonstrators. No casualties were reported. Sudan has been witnessing regular protests since the October coup led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The military takeover then derailed a power-sharing arrangement between army and civilian leaders following a 2019 ouster of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir. Nearly 80 people have been killed and hundreds of others injured since then. People are also calling for justice for those who were killed in military crackdowns. Abiyomi Azikiwe is the editor of Pan-African Newswire. He joined us earlier to give us some perspective on months-long protests against Sudan's military rulers.
The demonstrations are continuing. This has been going on for months. There are multiple demonstrations every week coming up on the 14th, this coming Monday. There's another general strike and mass demonstrations that are planned because the military is refusing to relinquish power. They have no faith, meaning the mass democratic movement in Sudan, in the military's capacity or ability or willingness to reform themselves. And the fact that they're being supported by external elements, for example, Hamedi, who is the head of the militias in Sudan, is visiting the United Arab Emirates because they are funding the Sudanese military to keep them in power. Also reports that a high-ranking official from Sudan, military official, is visiting Tel Aviv right now, which is supporting the military and is in opposition to the mass democratic movement. So they are taking on not only the domestic clients of these foreign interests, but the actual interests themselves that are backed by the United States.
The Yemeni army says it has successfully targeted Abha Airport in Saudi Arabia's southwestern region of Asir. Army spokesman Yahya Sarei says Asif K2 drones were used in the operation, which has reportedly disrupted flights at the airport. Sarei noted that the Saudi-led coalition has been using the airport for launching airstrikes against Yemen. The coalition's warplanes have bombed different regions across Yemen, including the capital Sana'a. Over the past day, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a war against the kingdom's southern neighbor in 2015 with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime there. The United States has been assisting the coalition with munitions and intelligence support. The war has brought about a severe humanitarian crisis in Yemen, pushing millions of people on the verge of starvation. Political commentator Ken Stone says the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is complicit in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. He says backing the war is part of American strategy to maintain its hegemony in the region.
It would never have started in the first place without the green light from Washington. And 1 year ago, when Biden announced suddenly that the U.S. was no longer going to support offensive Saudi operations in Yemen and was not going to transfer arms or sell arms to Saudi Arabia, he was blatantly lying through his teeth. It's clear that one cannot trust anything that comes out of Washington these days. The U.S. purpose in participating in this war of aggression is to maintain or even increase its hegemony over the entire strategic and oil-rich Middle East. And this has been the game of the U.S. for 70 years, and before them it was the game of the British Empire.
Reports say the United States will help the United Arab Emirates refill interceptors it uses to shoot down Yemeni missiles. Head of the U.S. Central Command in the Middle East, General Frank McKenzie, told media that Washington will do everything it can to assist the UAE in defending itself. The move would be in addition to the Pentagon's announcement last week of the deployment of a guided missile destroyer and advanced F-22 fighter jets to the UAE. Yemen forces have carried out a string of strikes on Emirati targets in recent weeks. That's in retaliation for the Saudi-led war launched on Yemen in 2015, in which Abu Dhabi is an active partner. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed, and millions others have been displaced due to war and blockade on the country. The 1979 Islamic Revolution was meant to fulfill long-cherished desire of independence for Iranians who had suffered decades of subjugation and domination by a monarchical rule with its nexus with some foreign powers. And one of the revolution's main promises was to keep the country away from all forms of dependence, either on the West or the East. The following report gives you an insight into the accomplishment of the Islamic Revolution and how it transformed Iranian society.
Neither East nor West, Islamic Republic. This famous slogan summarizes Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution and the people's fervent opposition to Cold War rivals, the United States and the Soviet Union, the two powers that then polarized the world sharply along the East-West divide. The slogan, which later became the Iranian foreign policy motto, was inspired by the ideas of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, who blamed the two powers for many problems faced by Iran and the Islamic world. He believed Muslims should reject the influence of both capitalism and communism. At the onset of the Islamic Revolution, many Iranians were tired of exploitation that culminated into Iran's losing big chunks of its territory to other countries. Therefore, the revolution kindled their hopes of independence and liberty. Iran's occupation by British and Russian empires in two world wars and the country's economic exploitation, directly or indirectly, were still fresh in the collective memory of Iranians. Also etched into people's psyche was how the U.S. and Britain engrossed their democratic aspirations in 1953 by orchestrating a coup against a popular government and returning the autocratic Shah to the throne. That coup consolidated the West's imperialistic agenda over Iran for a quarter of a century. In the 1970s, the Pahlavi regime was cheered by then-U.S. President Richard Nixon as one of, quote, America's cops on the beat in the Middle East for helping steer the oil-rich region away from the Soviet influence. In those days, the Pahlavi regime even obeyed the U.S. request to support its much-criticized war in Vietnam, sending warplanes, hosting American forces, and refueling warplanes. Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State under Nixon, admitted following the 1979 revolution that the Shah never failed to stand by the U.S. He described him as a man whom seven American presidents had lauded as a loyal ally. It was certainly a big blow for Washington to see the Shah ousted. The newly established Islamic Republic viewed both the U.S. and the Soviet Union as miscellaneous forces in international politics. The U.S. was referred to as the Great Satan, since it was the main backer of the Shah and posed the most immediate danger to the revolution. And the Soviet Union was regarded as the lesser Satan, since it was not seen as closely involved with the Iranian monarchy as the U.S. The most dramatic symbol of the revolutionary determination to assert independence was the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in November 1979 by a number of students. Angered by the U.S. admission of Shah, they asked Washington to hand over the former despot, a request that was never met. Iran's relations with the Soviet Union and its allies were tense as well, although at a low intensity. Tehran was opposed to numerous Soviet international policies, particularly its invasion of Afghanistan. In 1988, Imam Khomeini sent a letter to then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev warning him of an immediate danger. That letter has gone down in history as insightful and prophetic, from the leader of an independent nation to a superpower.
If you hope at this juncture to solve the economic problems of socialism and communism by appealing to the centers of the Western capitalism, you will, far from remedying any ill of your society, commit a mistake which those to come will have to erase.
The post-revolutionary Iran has now consolidated itself regionally and globally, forming warm relations with independent countries across the board. With the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Iran also pursued a look to the East policy, engaging in close collaboration with Russia and China. The independent Iran is now being regarded as a power that has contributed a lot to make the West Asian region more stable and peaceful. One such instance is Iran's role in defeating Daesh terrorism in Iraq, Syria, and beyond. Undoubtedly, Iran's Islamic Revolution was one of the biggest social upheavals of the 20th century. 43 years on, Imam Khomeini's words still resonate, and his powerful ideas of liberation from imperialistic domination, independence in domestic and foreign affairs, as well as call for embracing social justice and harmony, continue to inspire not only Iranians, but people in the region and beyond.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
To congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
In the limelight.
Toxic pesticides banned for use in the United Kingdom are being exported to countries with less stringent regulations under loopholes in international trade rules. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Daniel Buffy and Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled EU Plans to Ban Use of Synthetic Pesticides in Parks. Toxic pesticides banned for UK are exported to other countries. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a leaked draft regulation, the use of synthetic pesticides in parks and other green public spaces in urban areas is to be banned in the European Union, with member states obliged to cut overall use by 50%. The move is said by the European Commission to be necessary owing to the failure of a number of EU member states to act on previous guidance on reducing the use of chemical pest control. Officials say in the draft regulation that as a result of the proposals, European Union consumers could see increasing food prices, which might lead to increased imports from third countries with less strict regulation of pesticide use. But officials have said they will examine ways to mitigate the impact, adding that the EU needs to shift to a fair, healthy and environmentally friendly food system. Under the regulation, pesticides would also be banned in nature protection areas. About 70 towns and cities in the United Kingdom are taking steps to reduce pesticide use, but there is not a prohibition in law. A spokesperson for the Pesticide Action Network UK, or PAN-UK, called on the British government to follow Brussels' lead. Pesticide Action Network UK has been calling for such a measure for many years and to see the European Commission bringing forward plans to end the unnecessary use of pesticides in urban areas is very welcome. It will be a huge benefit for the citizens and environment of the European Union. PAN-UK would like to see the UK follow suit and end the use of pesticides in our towns and cities. The draft EU regulation, which will need to win the support of member states and the European Parliament, received a mixed reaction from environmental activists in mainland Europe. Concerns have been raised over the lack of strictures put on farmers to use methods such as crop rotation and mechanical weeding. Potential loopholes around the 50% target have also been identified, relating to a lack of confidence in the collection of accurate data. Sarah Weiner, a Green MEP, member of the European Parliament, said she feared the regulation would amount to empty promises. Sarah Weiner said the Commission's proposal on the sustainable use of pesticides in the European Union is anything but watertight. On the one hand, the Commission acknowledges that the old directive gives the member states too much leeway and consequently wants to turn it into a regulation. On the other hand, the Commission lists only insufficient measures to implement this basically good idea. Sarah Weiner added, not only that, but the Commission does not even want to make the basics of integrated pest management binding, which would be the absolute minimum to achieve lower pesticide use and protect human health and biodiversity. Furthermore, toxic pesticides banned for use in the United Kingdom are being exported to countries with less stringent regulations under loopholes in international trade rules. According to documents obtained by Greenpeace UK's Unearthed investigation and the Swiss non-governmental organisation Public Eye, in freedom of information requests, two companies, Syngenta and INEOS, are exporting from UK facilities large quantities of pesticides based on chemicals that would be illegal for use in the European Union. Export notification data for 2018 showed Syngenta planned to ship more than 28,000 tons of pesticide containing paraquat, which was banned for use in the United Kingdom in 2007. Paraquat, which is fatal at small doses if ingested, can damage the lungs, eyes, kidneys and heart through long-term exposure. Inovin, a subsidiary of the chemicals firm INEOS, made export notifications for 4,000 tonnes of the soil fumigant 1,3-dichloropropene, a suspected carcinogen banned in the European Union because of the risk it poses to wildlife and groundwater. The United Kingdom was responsible for about 40% of the exports of these and similar products from the European Union in 2018, the year to which the documents apply. While exporting these products is legal, despite the restrictions on their use in Europe, campaigners want the practice banned altogether because of the likely harm to the importing countries. Baskut Tunkak, who was from 2014 to 2020, was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the implications for human rights of the environmentally sound management and disposal of hazardous substances and waste, said, "The United Kingdom must urgently end the export of paraquat and 1,3-dichloropropane. These pesticides are among the worst of the worst, unquestionably hazardous to human health." In July, Buskat Tunkak and 35 experts from the Human Rights Council called for an end to such exports from rich nations to the developing world. France is enacting a ban, which came into force from 2022, but other countries have been reluctant to place constraints on their industries. Some of the pesticides are destined for developing countries, including Colombia, Ecuador, Mexico, India, and Indonesia. According to the data, large amounts are also sold to rich nations. The United States and Australia buy quantities of paraquat, and Japan takes paraquat as well as 1,3-dichloropropane. Tunkak said, "Just because a country is wealthy does not mean there are not grave human rights violations and abuses being committed against vulnerable communities. In the United States, where 3 times more pesticide products are registered for use, farm workers suffer more chemical-related injuries and illnesses than any other workforce. The racial dimension cannot be ignored, with so many agricultural and food workers from migrant and minority backgrounds." Doug Parr, chief scientist at Greenpeace UK, said selling the pesticides was exploitative hypocrisy and urged ministers to end the practice. Doug Parr said, "The United Kingdom is at the heart of a pesticide scandal that allows chemical giants to flood other countries, many of them poorer nations, with toxic chemicals on a major scale." Doug Parr added, "These pesticides are so dangerous that we've made the very sensible decision to ban their use in our own country and across Europe. But what gives us the right to think it is morally defensible to continue producing and shipping them around the world?" Other European nations are also exporting thousands of tons of pesticides that would be disqualified for use in Europe itself. In terms of European Union law, companies exporting certain substances must notify governments under a rule known as the Prior Informed Consent Regulation, overseen by the European Chemicals Agency, ECHA, which provides a list of exports. According to the agency's latest report, from last December, the United Kingdom, Belgium, Netherlands and Spain together exported 9,016 tons of 1,3-dichloropropane and the amount of paraquat and the herbicide trifluralin exported by the United Kingdom, Spain and Italy amounted to 15,983 tons. Greenpeace said its data differed from that published by the European Union because it came from export notifications, so it was not certain that the exact amounts intended to be sent abroad were exported, while the European Chemicals Agency ECHA data bundled together different chemicals for various purposes.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and our heartiest congratulations to you all on yet another anniversary of the glorious victory of the Islamic Revolution. As Iran steps into its 43rd year as the role model of popular religious rule for all the peoples and all countries, to the detriment of the hypocrites, the terrorists, the Zionists, the Wahhabis, the imperialists, and the entire unjust system of global arrogance. We have chosen for you a beautiful hadith from the Holy Prophet's seventh infallible heir, Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him, that seems to refer to the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, who changed for good the destiny of the Iranian people. A man from Qom will rise and invite people towards the truth. Around him will gather people like slabs of iron, who will stand firm against strong winds and storms, and will never get tired of war. They know not fear and have trust in Allah. The outcome is for the pious.
Epic. Glory. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
غیرت شور غزل غزل آیه بنو از ابتدا تا انتها مردمی از جنس غرور
اگر ادبا چیزی را
See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid, millat Iran, millat mojza asay qarn ast.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience. And welcome to a new program called The Man Who Changed the World. This program is going to speak about the life and times of Imam Khomeini. And we are going to delve into the biography of this great divine personality who certainly shaped the future for tomorrow. And we are going to speak about in depth various dimensions and aspects of this great personality and, of course, the impact that he made around the globe in terms of the Islamic Revolution of 1979 here in Iran. I myself am the host of the program. My name is Ijaz Hosseini, and I'm going to have an expert in the studio who is going to help me through this discussion about this great personality, and that's Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who is an Islamic scholar and researcher. Salam, Sayyid, and thank you very much for being on the program and giving your valuable time to us. Thanks.
Alaykum Salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Great. So, as they say, let's begin at the beginning, and we begin with the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, on this great personality of Imam Khomeini. And we wish to, first of all, I think, as we say, begin with his birth and his lineage, his family background, of course, in Khomein, which is a small town here in central Iran, and not very far from the holy city of Qom. I think it's only a few hours' drive. And we want to, first of all, begin with the significance of the birthday of the of this Imam, and speak a bit about his family background and what were the ingredients in which this great personality was being shaped which then, of course, inspired the rest of us, both in the East and the West, as Muslims. So, Sayyid Taqi, can you give us a bit of a background on the lineage of Imam Khomeini, the family background, and, of course, the very humble beginnings Indeed. Of this great personality in 1902, which is just at the beginning of the 20th century. Indeed. But, of course, there's a big history involved here as well in Iran in terms of the fact that, you know, oil was being discovered, and that became a curse as well as a blessing for Iran. But at the same time, of course, there was the world powers at that time. The British were dominant throughout the world. So there's a very complicated background to all this, but it helps us to try to put things into perspective. So let us start with the humble beginnings of this Imam. May God bless his great soul.
Inshallah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Thank you.
Of course, we know his name was Ruhullah Musvi Khomeini.
Yes.
And that in itself is interesting name-giving as far
right.
as his
right.
Father, Sayyid Mustafa, was concerned.
Yes.
Calling him the Spirit of God, Ruhullah.
Ruhullah, yes.
You know, that is an interesting grace in itself. That
it's a connotation which was used with Prophet Jesus because it really had a big impact in the
indeed,
West in that
but,
terms.
But then you look at how you know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you could almost say, enlightened his father to select this name as a name for his newborn child.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, being born on a very auspicious day as well, the Wiladat of Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salam Alayha.
That's right, the birthday of this great holy daughter of the
exactly.
Holy Prophet, peace be upon him.
He was born
yes.
on the 20th of Jamad al-Thani.
Yeah.
1320.
Yes, 1320.
Hijri,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is same as which correlates to the 24th of September,
1902.
And what's really interesting, when we look at a brief background to him first, before we move into a little bit of his life history, which we come across when we, of course, when we learn more and more about this learned person, it's always important. You know, it's
yes.
funny, a lot of our youths in the world know when Michael Jackson was born, where he lived, and but we don't really know the...
that is what we call the superfluous and useless information
exactly.
that
but
people
our youths are not
right.
encouraged towards learning more about their learned personalities,
of
and
course.
Therefore it's paramount
but
that...
In a sense, Sayyidina, you know, Imam Khomeini was no less an icon. I mean, the images...
Indeed, but then, you know, the
global.
Iconic image of Imam Khomeini obviously has its, you know, its depth in closeness to God, not closeness to Shaitan. So we see, of course, the iconicness is in the lineage to start with. The very
Absolutely.
Fact that his family is an offspring of Bibi Fatima Zahra Salamul Alayha, her great-great-great-great-grandson, Hazrat Musi Kazim, Imam Musi Kazim, alayhi salam.
And, of course, he's, of course, the natural descendant of Imam al-Hussein.
Indeed.
And the thing is, that I don't want to jump the gun here, mm-hmm. but, you know, you can't help when you read about this great personality that how many parallels you draw with Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Indeed.
And this is something, inshallah, we'll speak about in a later program, but at this moment in time, We'll stick to the lineage.
See, what's really amazing is that when we go back to his great great grandparents, kind of back a little
Absolutely.
Bit, we find that his parents were his generations back originated from Nishapur, and they migrated.
Right.
They migrated to Hindustan. Stayed there. And
that's right. His great-grandfather was in India, wasn't he?
Indeed.
If you recall his name for
Sayyid
us.
Sayyid Ahmad Musavi Al-Hindi, he was known
Al-Hindi,
as.
Yes.
But
yes,
what happened was that when they moved, when he moved from in the early 19th century,
Interesting.
Very early 19th century, they went and settled in Lucknow. In
the great Shia center of
and
India.
Not only just the Shia center at that time, the one of the sole Shia you could say the kingdoms, the Ohda kingdom.
That's correct,
of
sir.
The followers of the 12th imam,
correct, sir.
12
yes.
imams in
yes.
fact they
yes.
were the first of the Shia kingdoms in
India.
Hindustan,
that's right,
in India. Lining up with the Safavis, probably the Safavis at a latter time.
That's right, because they were always in conflict with the Mughals
exactly.
of India.
So they went and settled in an area called Kintur.
Kintur,
right. Kintur,
K-I-N-T-O-O-R.
Near, just outside Lucknow, it was.
Right.
And as it happens that because his grandfather of the past of Imam Khomeini, was himself a learned personality.
Of course.
And when he settled in Lucknow, he was counted amongst the scholars of the time.
The top-notch scholars
High-ranking scholars. And you must appreciate, of course, at that time, being a Shia kingdom, Farsi being a very important language within the Muslim kingdoms at that time.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Because at that time, we are talking about before the British...
In fact, you're talking about 1830s.
Right, okay. In that but even period. Then, Farsi was still pretty much in use because English was still hadn't taken hold by the Imperial British at that time.
Indeed, it was still in the scholars' circle.
It was still being used,
And particularly when it came to people's want to know about Islam, they still approached people who were embedded with Arabic and Farsi as their natural contact to Islam. You know,
say that it's very interesting what you're saying, because, of course, the scholars who come from Lucknow speak Urdu in a totally different way. They have a completely different style, and it's more Farsi-orientated than it is in normal people who speak the language, because, of course, Urdu meant army of words, which was a mixture of Turkish and Farsi, and, of course, then the British put their input into it. But, of course, their style of speaking is entirely different, so that's interesting.
Because the linguistics of Lucknow, or the spoken Urdu of Lucknow, it's much more sophisticated from what I understand.
It is, yes.
But then you see, it's again the dominance of the ulemaiyat in it, the scholaristic scholastic links.
Rich legacy in
indeed,
there.
Indeed, that has remained. And in fact, even after Hindustan being taken over by the Hindus and
the British.
The international. No, I'm talking about after 1947 and the national language becoming Hindi.
Urdu
with this sophistication has still lingered on in Lucknow.
Yeah, yeah.
But at that time, coming back to the time of Sayyid Ahmed Musawi Hindi, he, as I said, counted amongst the scholars of that time, within the Indian scholars who were there, because, of course, India has always had a very good link with Islamic environments of Najaf and Karbala of long time.
Absolutely, and there's a rich tradition in
indeed.
There.
Indeed, in the early times when the British did take over England, they understood the roles of the Hausa in India because they had contacts with Najaf and Karbala.
That's right.
And Hausas in Lucknow were held in very high regards by the Hausa of Najaf and Karbala.
Of course, this was the elite. This was the most esteemed institutions for the training of Shia clergy and in terms of the dissemination of the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Indeed, and Lucknow played a very major role in this particular the kingdom of Ohde. Played a very important role in promoting Shi'it, O-U-D-H, in northern India. Mm-hmm. It had a great role to play.
Right.
But what happened as we come closer to the time of Imam Khomeini's time, is that when British was being... again, you could see the element of what you're trying to put in regarding Imam Hussein fighting the Zalim oppressor
and
everything. We find in the history of Sayyid Ahmed is that he has to move away from Lucknow, leaving his family or his forefathers, because he couldn't stand taking the influence of the British in India.
That's true.
You see,
because, of course, this is a very dark chapter in the history of India. Because
not only in the history of India,
but
it's in the history of the East Indian Company. A very dark chapter.
Very nice.
You know, for example, I mean, this is a point we've raised before in some other program. East Indian Company was an extremely oppressive entity.
We're talking about the famous jihad of 1857 now, the Indian mutiny.
The Indian mutiny in itself, but the consequences of those Indian mutiny were the facts that the British were being so oppressive to promote their capitalist doctrine that oppression was a kind of a natural progression of capitalism. You know, I'm sure you might have heard about the atrocities they committed on the weavers of India.
Of course, the big gun.
Not only the use of the big gun, the use of the small knife even.
Yeah.
Because what happened is that the British, they were taking raw cotton from India and taking it to Manchester.
That's
and
right.
building the capital system of
and
Britain.
And undercutting the domestic market.
Undercutting on itself. What you're cutting into a conversation is this, that not only were they bringing in cotton from England,
sure,
in the form of shirts and things to sell to the raw market where they were getting the cotton.
Yeah,
but they were finding out that their cotton could not compete with the local made cotton.
Yes.
Because the local made cotton was so more finer.
Hmm.
So on the investigation, they found out that there were female young girl weavers throughout India who were weaving cotton, which was much, much, much more softer and
better quality than
indeed,
what was coming out.
Indeed, because that was really coarse.
Sure.
So you know what the East Indian Company did? It went and arrested all these girls, and they only released them with a guarantee that they will not produce cotton again.
Mm-hmm.
And to make sure they will not produce cotton again, mm-hmm, they cut off the girls' fingers.
Oh, my God. That is barbaric.
So that is capitalism.
That is barbaric.
That is the barbaric, oppressive observation Imam Khomeini's great-great-grandfather was seeing when the British were taking over. So he wanted
horrendous
to part from that environment. Mm. And in the history of Imam Khomeini's grandfather, in fact, because Sayyid Ahmed later on becomes Imam Khomeini's grandfather, he moves away from Lucknow.
Mm.
On the way, wanting to come to Najaf and Karbala, he relocates himself in the Kashmiri Valley. And from Kashmir, he makes his way towards Najaf and Karbala.
Interesting. Very interesting.
And it's really interesting that in Najaf,
mm-hmm,
whilst he's there in Najaf and continues some element of his studies,
mm-hmm,
he comes across a person who was known as a very big businessman type of orientated individual of Khomein.
Right.
And he was quite interested in bringing an Alim al-Din to Khomein to settle.
Right.
And so happened, as God may have wished it to be, or God would have wished it to be, that he directed this gentleman called Yusuf Khan.
Yusuf Khan.
Yes,
right.
He was a very important person, a prominent citizen of Khomeini.
Right.
He got associated with Imam Khomeini, Imam Khomeini's grandfather,
right,
Sayyid Ahmed, and invited him, mm-hmm, to come and settle in Khomeini.
Interesting. Very
and
interesting.
In settling in Khomeini, Yusuf Khan then gave Sayyid Ahmed Khomeini his daughter in marriage.
Right.
And thereupon, that relationship with Khomeini becomes a lot more molded,
mm-hmm,
for the Imam Khomeini's family,
right,
in the sense that that circle from Nishapur to Hindustan.
And this marriage of this daughter, she comes from a very religious background,
Yusuf Khan was known to be a very religious person, that's
right,
why he had gone to Najaf to actually locate an individual to come in, be a resident, so as to say, resident Maulana, as we would say, or resident Alim al-Din, resident scholar of that area. So, yeah, his religiousness is quite clear,
sure,
that he wanted to have this type of rapport,
mm-hmm,
with learned scholars. So Sayyid Ahmed is invited to reside in Khomeini,
right,
with the fact that he's given, Yusuf Khan gives him his daughter,
sure,
to make that consistency firm.
Roughly what time are we talking about in terms of the calendar?
I think, you know, Imam Khomeini was born in, we say Imam Khomeini was born in 1902. His grandfather would have migrated from India maybe in 1870, 1880.
Interesting.
So that type of lineage of time.
Time.
That way, the chronological period that we're talking about.
You know, becoming settled in the town of Khomeini. Yeah.
Because, you see, we've got a date here which talks about birth of Imam Khomeini's father,
mm-hmm,
as being 1885.
1885.
Imam Khomeini's father.
Right.
Musfi al-Hindi, he was
Al-Hindi.
Known as. So in 1885, and his sister, Sahiba.
Sahiba.
They're two children to Sayyid Ahmed and his wife,
sure,
these two people.
Right.
And of course, both of them have leave a very important impact in Imam Khomeini's upbringing.
Sure, absolutely. I think we'll go away for a short break at this moment, Sayyidina. You beautifully introduced, the idea of the settlement of, Sayyid al-Hindi, the grandfather, into the town of Khomeini, getting married there. And then, inshallah, we're going to move on to Imam Khomeini's father and, the role he played in Khomeini. Of course, he was a great scholar, a man of great stature and esteem in the town of Khomeini. But, of course, at a very volatile history of Iran, because, of course, huge changes are happening. There's the constitutional movement here in Iran, which had very negative impact on the country in terms of, you know, the imperialist hand behind it because of the British who were, you know, making their sphere of influence in the south of the country. And, of course, you know, oil gets discovered because, of course, Iran was the first place in the world where oil was discovered. So a lot of these elements are now going to play a huge role in, you know, the coming of Imam Khomeini. But we'll go away for a short break for a couple of minutes, and then, inshallah, we'll, God willing, we'll introduce this dimension of Khomeini after the break. Please stay with us. We'll be back after a couple of minutes. Thank you.
ما الإمام إلا الحاكم بالكتاب القائم بالقسط الدائن بدين الحق الحابس نفسه على
Thank you, listeners, for staying with us. You're listening to the program, The Man Who Changed the World. And, of course, this is about the life and times of Imam Khomeini. And I'm your expert host, Ijaz Husseini, on this program. And I also have the honor and pleasure of having Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who's an Islamic scholar and researcher in the city of Qum. And we got to the stage, Sayyidina, about where you were talking about the history of Imam Khomeini's grandfather, Sayyid Ahmad al-Hindi. And of course, you mentioned the fact that, you know, he's left India in 1830 to go to Najaf. He meets this prominent citizen of Khomeini, Yusuf Khan, and you introduce the stage of Sayyid al-Hindi's life where he's now going to settle in Khomeini. And you certainly mentioned around 1870 that this takes place, and he gets married to a very pious lady there. And this is now the point at which we are now going to discuss, of course, Imam Khomeini's father and in the city of Khomeini and in the background of the volatile constitutional movement in Iran, which, you know, was the setup really up leading up to the First World War, where we get the end of the Qajar dynasty, which was very corrupt, very weak at the end, very much influenced by the imperialists and, of course, the clergy. And if you could go into that aspect, you know, about the clergy taking a stand, you know, we've got the tobacco movement, you know, the great fatwa of Ayatollah al-Shirazi, you know, already showing that especially the Shia clergy, especially the school of Ahl al-Bayt, is at the forefront of the resistance to this very dark chapter in the Muslim world. You know, as you said, as you introduced it from India with the East Indian Company. But of course, we are talking about the whole Muslim world being affected by a very dark colonial period in which we are talking about certain lights of resistance. And in that background, if you could say, then, you know, carry on with the story about what happens in Khomeini.
We came up to the point where, you know, he's invited and he's settled in Khomeini.
That's right.
And and all the time, during his time in Khomeini,
sure,
Sayyid Ahmad had always kept a rapport. Sayyid Ahmad al-Musawi al-Hindi, later the family becomes Khomeini.
Sure.
With his point of origin of that time, which was Hind. Largely because of the
with
fact
India, that, of course.
With India. Mm-hmm. Largely because of the fact that, as I said, there was always a very sound interaction with the ulema circles, wherever they were.
That's
because
right.
they had no concern about borders.
That's true. Yes,
and therefore,
absolutely.
It was of you know, it didn't matter whether you were giving a fatwa or Islamic decree which related to the Chinese Muslims or the Indian Muslims or so as to say the British Muslims. It's uniform as far as its application.
This is also, you know, it takes us back to that wonderful hadith from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, which says that if one part of the body is suffering of the Muslim ummah, the pain goes to the rest of the body. And you know, in that light, The holy clergy of the school of Ahl al-Bayt have always worked
Indeed.
In this manner,
and you see,
according to this hadith.
And particularly if you look at then, you know, after Imam Khomeini's grandfather,
sure.
The family settles in Khomeini as a part and parcel of that community without any constraints of any type. Even the friends recognize them as did the foe. or that they were part and parcel of that community and had a great impact on the ordinary people of Khomeini.
Sure.
And particularly as you pointed out, the tremendous changes that were taking place.
That's right. Yes.
And
yes.
The fact that everybody was suffering. In fact, the suffering was even right to the servants of the kings as well. You know, those who were of high regards within the king's circles were also suffering because the king, because of his allegiances that he was creating with other people, were affecting the friends that he was creating at home and the enemies he was creating.
I mean, we're talking about a history here, not only in Iran, but also, of course, that had affected the Mughal Empire of India, the Ottoman Empire to the north of the Turks, of course. But, of course, you know, this was happening in stages. You know, we were seeing a terrible decline in the culture, in the power and the prestige of the Muslim world. And, of course, you know, the Europeans were making huge inroads into this part of the world. And in that background, we are seeing this, you know, especially the clergy, taking up the mantle of resistance against this movement.
If we were to look at, just to sidetrack a little bit, we find that most of the most of the movements against the imperialistic powers who are the Muslim communities were led by ulema.
Ulema, absolutely.
You know,
if
you even go all the way to Indonesia, where you had people, you had the movements who were revolting against the Dutch.
That's right. They were led by the expansion of the Dutch Empire in that part of the world. Yeah.
They were led by ulema, to which we find, you know, in South Africa, which was also a Dutch colony, that we have these Malaysian, Indonesian exiles who were exiled from Indonesia, settled in South Africa.
I mean, the other thing that we need to point out here, although we're not sidetracking at all, because we have to put this background into the fore, because this helps us to understand Imam Khomeini's movement, you know, at a much later stage, because it doesn't come out of the blue. It comes out of a very dark period in our history. But at the same time, we have to mention the fact that, you know, that the French Empire under Napoleon and the British, you know, were fighting over India. I mean, it wasn't like something like, you know, it was just one particular movement and then the East Indian Company happens. This all comes out of a background where the Europeans are now fighting for their own markets in this part of the world. And, you know, this barbarism, this colonialism is coming out of the fact that they're fighting and vying for their interests in this
and
part
was, of the world. And whilst going out for their interest, they didn't realize that amongst the scholars, there were people who were not going to take either side, but the side of truth.
That's right.
And in
this is very interesting.
And in doing so, you find, you know, the various movements, even at a later date when you have the constitutional movement in Iran, or you have the anti-British movements in India, anti-Dutch movements in Indonesia.
And a lot of that stemmed out of Lucknow as well, because it was really the Shia ulama who were the... But of course, we had people like Sultan Tipu, for example, although they were monarchs, we are not talking about them as Islamic movement.
They had their support from the ulema of those.
That's right, to make
who
the jihad
anti colonial characteristics.
Yes,
and
yes.
Yeah, as it so happened, if you look at the way, for example, Atatürk worked, he destroyed the ulema's strength.
That's right.
So throughout history, we see wherever the system has gone and annihilated the ulema, the movements of people have died out.
Well, and Atatürk did the thing with the Swiss code thing, that he wanted to, you know, completely manipulate the Sharia. You know, he wanted to remove the holy Sharia.
This is where that's why the ulema stand out.
Yeah,
and you see, coming back to Imam Khomeini's father, we see that was born in a very difficult time, 1880s. He was born in 1885. As up to 1902, to the point of Imam Khomeini's birth, we see that he has taken on a very revolutionary position himself against the criminals of the time who were supported by the Shah of that time, you know, the Khaja who had appointed his own stooges in the area.
Well, this is a point we have to mention, because this is a very interesting event that takes place with the town of Khomeini, because the town of Khomeini was constantly being raided by Khans and their government lackeys, because, of course, you know, the Khaja government was very weak. I mean, the central authority in Tehran had absolutely couldn't control the law and order of the country. And, you know, the British took advantage of this because they for their own interest, trying to get footholds into Iran, into certain ustans, if you like, the certain provinces of Iran, where they wanted to, you know, especially, you know, look for oil. You know, I mean, this was one of the main motivations for the British to be in Iran. And, of course,